This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and joining me as he is every single show is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, your desk is looking very messy. I take it that your orb of mail has become too full and the back door has popped open.
It really has, Chris. I was just sitting here at work today, and then all of a sudden, an explosion of orbs just everywhere. And I was like, where am I going to put all of these? Luckily, I was able to find a way to miniaturize them.
Okay.
And then kind of put them back into the orb mailbox. And so luckily today we're going to be pulling those out and kind of talking through some of those orbs we've received and from the listeners, and some great questions and some great thoughts from the listeners. I love when we do this because it's a lot of fun, mainly just because it makes me think on my feet.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, this will be the second of our supplemental shows, The Orb of Mail. And let's just jump in here, Matthew. We've got a lot of things we're going to go over. Some of these are a little bit lengthy. We're going to read them to you, so bear with us here. We want to share the thoughts of our listeners with everyone as well. The first one we have here, Matthew, is from Greg Mullenby. And he wrote into us about our episode where we discussed Red Squad. Valiant, the episode, but also Red Squad. And Greg said, your conversation, like a lot of your conversations, allowed me to see an episode I hate and I still don't like in a different light. In fact, after our Twitter conversation and thinking about what you guys were thinking in terms of wanting to show Red Squad in a more positive light, I was thinking, what if Red Squad was a barrier of entry into Section 31? It's kind of like that scene in Men in Black, where the guys are there taking these simple tests, yet there was a lot more to that. What if Red Squad was something like that, but only for Section 31? I mean, Sloan himself would have made a good Red Squad member, and I think we saw another Section 31 agent who was like Ferris. So what do you think about this, Matthew? I love the Men in Black reference, by the way.
I do too. Because it was just on TV not too long ago, and it's kind of flipping through, and I was like, this movie is so freaking good. Yeah. So I need to go get Men in Black. But on the actual topic, I do think it makes sense a little bit. Actually, we see that in the ongoing comics that Red Squad members tend to be a part of Section 31. And we see that with them trying to recruit Sulu to be part of Section 31, right. And we find that they don't actually end up recruiting him. They recruit his sister, though. So this is something that actually has happened in Star Trek lore. This is an episode that I think makes a lot of people kind of be like, huh? But it's more interesting than I remembered, especially as we went through it. And the idea of it being kind of a test for Section 31 is something that really I like. I like Greg's idea. I'm going to make that part of my headcanon.
It makes you wonder if maybe it was set up just for that purpose, because I don't picture that everyone who goes into Red Squad goes into Section 31, but I can imagine the reverse, that everyone in Section 31, or almost everyone, was a Red Squad member.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that what we see Red Squad do, especially like in Homefront and Paradise Lost, mm-hmm. being a part of that and everything there, just seems like something Section 31 would want to snatch up.
Yeah,
these kids are pretty much willing to do whatever it takes and whatever they're told to do. And that seems like a good path starting on for Section 31. Mm-hmm. So,
well, yeah, because Section 31 needs to vet people. They need to find out, are you willing to do things that the average person would think was ethically wrong and would refuse to do on principle? Would you do those things if you're asked? And if you ask Red Squad members to do various things, like they did in Homefront and Paradise Lost, that's a great way to find out this person is a candidate, this person's not.
Yeah, definitely. It really does kind of come together as an idea for me.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine, you know, a better training ground, a better place for Section 31 to kind of grab people from than by watching the cadets of Red Squad.
Definitely. So thanks for that message, Greg. That's something that I had never thought about before until you mentioned it, but it does make a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I love it. That's one of those things, again, it just the listeners making me think.
Yeah.
Well, Nicholas Isles wrote us, Chris, and he said, what are your thoughts on the new design of Deep Space Nine in the relaunch books? And do you think it was a wise decision to destroy the original station?
All right. What do I like the new design. I think that it makes, I think that they did a nice job in designing it to pay respect to the Cardassian station that we know from the television series, while still making it feel like something that Starfleet would build, and also giving it sort of a retro feel as well.
You know, the decision to actually blow up the station as a huge Niner was quite a blow for me. Reading that in the books, it was hard. And then I remembered, you know, in the end, we have seen a lot of Star Trek ships, our favorite ships, get blown up. You know, the original Enterprise was refit, and then it's blown up in 3. We've seen the Defiant lost. We've seen the Enterprise D being crashed on, you know, a planet by Troy. I don't know how if that really counts, but we end up losing the Enterprise D, you know, so we lose a lot of Enterprises. But it was really interesting, I think, to see them have the guts to in the books do something huge and destroy the station.
Well, let me ask you this, Matthew, because you and I, one thing that we love about storytelling and one reason we love Deep Space Nine is we want to see our characters evolve and we want to see them progress through their lives, and we don't want to see things stagnate. And at this point, Terek Nor has been around for a long time, but Starfleet has been in control of that station for many years by the time it's destroyed. And if you have a show like The Next Generation or Voyager or any of these shows where you're dealing with a ship that goes from place to place, you can progress your characters by having them simply be transferred to another ship or go somewhere else. And we did see a little bit of that on DS9 as well. But in the end, the DS9 story is being told in this one stationary location. So I think at some point, for the health of the storytelling, you need to have a change. And so destroying that station and having a new one built makes sense to me, even though it might be shocking and it might be hard to take as someone who loves that station. Life changes, time marches on, and nothing lasts forever. So from a storytelling standpoint, I personally think it was a good decision to destroy the station so that you could further evolve that story, because at some point it will start to feel stagnant.
Well, and at the same time, just think about it from an end-universe perspective. I mean, a derelict Cardassian ore mining facility has been the bustling hub for what's been going on with the Gamma Quadrant and in that part of the Alpha Quadrant for a very long time now, 7 years. And it honestly, in some ways, it makes sense for Starfleet just to replace it in the first place.
Yeah.
To have a state-of-the-art station there that is going to be something that could better guard the wormhole.
Yeah.
And at the same time, also be a major hub for all sorts of different people coming from, especially the Gamma Quadrant and other places.
Yeah.
So I just think it really makes sense. And I like you, I think the new design does a great job of paying homage to what we had before, but at the same time giving us something very Starfleet and just awesome. I mean, I couldn't be more excited by the fact that maybe one day we might get some schematics for that brand new station and hear more about it.
A lot of people
and that's
that.
One of the things I'm so excited about with the new Deep Space Nine books is just to have more of that station explained to me.
Yeah, definitely.
So I like the idea. It was tough to lose, but it's great to have the new Deep Space Nine around. So.
And for those screaming spoilers right now, you can see on the book covers the new DS9 station. So, you know, all you need to do is just browse shelves and you'll see that there's a new station. So at some point,
yeah, Blame Barms.
We're not telling you when it happened or anything like that. So you can read the books and be surprised. But at some point, the station is replaced. So thanks for that letter, Nicholas.
So Martin Dunn wrote in and he said, "Hi, me again. I just thought about your Kira and O'Brien episode and the Keiko role in things. He says, I don't think that she was willfully ignorant in pushing Miles towards Kira and them together. I always took it as more that she trusted Miles and knew nothing would ever happen. So she probably did see little hints, as you say, but I think she dismissed them out of hand. She's confident enough in her marriage that it would never occur to her that anything could happen between them. And so she didn't worry about it. In pushing Miles and Kira together, she was just being more practical. She needs a massage. You're good at massages, give her a massage, for crying out loud. Yes, it might have been nice for her to actually say out loud why she's had no problem with it. But on the other hand, the fact that she didn't need to say anything is a stronger message. I think it's assumed that she's rock solid in her marriage to Miles. People have had to spend as much time apart as they have over the 7 years would have to have a level of confidence in each other. And at the end, she was right. Miles did make the right decision. She really did have nothing to worry about."
Yeah, I was thinking about this one. And the, you know, some things here parallel my own marriage in that, you know, my wife and I have been together for a very long time. We've been together, we've been married for 17 years. We've been together for 20. And we've also had times where we've had to spend an extended period of time apart, you know, as long as 9 months apart for different reasons, dealing with where we were living and work and things like that. And so I completely get what Martin is saying here about the relationship and the trust, and I agree with that. And obviously we have a rock solid relationship to be apart that long. At the same time, if I were there with Kira like Miles was here and my wife were Keiko coming in, she wouldn't have taken it like Keiko. She would have said something. So I don't know. I kind of agree with what you say here, Martin, but not completely. And the other thing is that I'm not sure that I agree with the idea that Miles and Keiko have this wonderful rock solid relationship. I actually often get the impression from Keiko that she's very frustrated with their circumstances and she's not happy with the assignments that Miles gets and she doesn't really want to be there and that she looks for reasons to remove herself from the situation.
I'm in complete agreement with you, Chris. I like what Martin says. I think some of it is true and plays out in the episode, but there's this whole other side that I guess, and I think probably it comes across more in the way that Keiko is played on the show than it is necessarily maybe the writing even. She always just kind of seems to be in a bad mood or just kind of snappy at Miles or in all of those things. And so she doesn't ever really seem to be very happy or loving towards him in a lot of ways. Right. And even when she is, it's just like, there's just a disconnect. There's no chemistry there between those two actors for me. And so
yeah, I agree. I
guess I'm with you too in that, you know, about to get married, just in 11 days. And I think that if I was, you know, massaging another girl in that manner, even if she was having our child, my fiance would be very upset. For me to be spending that much time. Yeah.
Well, definitely in your situation, because it's a new relationship. In my case, where we're talking 20 years, I still think she would be upset. So I'm not sure I can.
Well, especially if you were helping her out.
Agree
of the
on
tub.
That. Picking up here real quick, you talk about how Keiko is always in a bad mood, it seems. She does seem like that to me a lot as well. I got an email from listener Brad Alexander about this same topic about Keiko. And there's one portion that I want to share here because this is what we're talking about. He asked me, does your wife watch and enjoy Deep Space Nine? If so, what is her opinion of Keiko O'Brien? And he also went on to say, the one thing that really irritates me is that Rosalind Kao is of Chinese descent, yet Keiko is supposed to be Japanese. The same thing with John Cho, a Korean playing Hikaru Sulu, another Japanese person. Kind of like the point you made in Time's Orphan about the woman that played the older Molly O'Brien. And I just wanted to answer this here on the Orb of Mail. Yes, my wife does watch Deep Space Nine and she really enjoys it. It's her favorite Star Trek. I don't really know, though, if she has any real opinion about Keiko. It's been a long time since we watched DS9 together. What I'll say about Keiko, though, is that she isn't Japanese. She doesn't act Japanese on the show. This character's not written like a Japanese woman. When I watch Keiko, ethnically, she's Korean, of course, as you said here, and she's supposed to be Japanese on the show. But even then, she's American. That's what, you know, a Japanese American or a Korean American, they're not going to act like an actual Japanese or a Korean person in Korea or Japan, because they're living in American culture, so they're behaving as they would in that culture. So when I see Keiko and I see her behavior, she doesn't react to things the way a Japanese woman would. So that respect, in terms of Brad's question here, I don't think we can really even form an opinion about Keiko as her being a Japanese woman on the show, because the character doesn't act Japanese.
Yeah, and you know, Star Trek has people be an ethnicity, but then they usually pull out the kind of stereotypes for it, because those are apparently the only things that stay around in the 24th century, you know? I mean, geez, Patrick Stewart is not French, doesn't sound French. He's completely British.
Which I don't have a problem with, by the way, because, like, I wouldn't expect Keiko to act like a 21st century Japanese woman. They're in the 24th century. They're not on Earth. You know, it's like me. I mean, I'm American by birth, but Americans would probably look at me as being kind of strange because I don't live in that culture. I adapt the culture I'm in. So anyway, I think we may have hijacked Martin's question here a little bit, but I wanted to mention this one from Brad because it tied into Keiko as well. And the other thing I did want to mention from the Babel Conference, our listeners group, Matthew, is that Ruth, she mentioned something I thought was really important that we couldn't really bring to our discussion, is that we're not women, so we can't really feel the woman's perspective. But she talked about how maybe Keiko felt guilty that she couldn't carry the baby, and she was overly accommodating, perhaps, of the situation. She wanted to make sure Keiko was taken very good care of, and maybe she had some guilt that she wasn't the one carrying her own child.
I don't even know how to comment on that because you can't really think about it from the woman's perspective. Right. So that could be completely true. I never would have thought of that. Yeah.
I think that Ruth had a really good point there, though, that could be the case. And it's something that we just really, as men, can't really think about why, because there are hormones involved as well, right? And those affect how you think. Your body changes when you're carrying a child. So I think that could be very valid. And if that's the case, maybe the writing could make more sense than we're giving it credit for. All right. So thank you for that letter, Martin. And now back to Brad, who I just mentioned. Brad also wrote in and gave us a lengthy rundown about Worf and Jadzia. Brad said, I have a few thoughts on Worf and Trek, both TNG and DS9, that I would like to share. I am a Klingon fan and enjoyed their development in TNG and DS9. Worf and Sisko. I think that Sisko thought of Worf as a protege. Sisko has more Klingon in him than he was probably willing to admit, which is why he gravitated to Curzon and later Jadzia and Ezri Dax. Much as Curzon developed a young Ben Sisko as a lieutenant, Captain Benjamin Sisko took Worf and started to develop him for command. That is why Sisko drove home the lessons after the trial in Rules of Engagement. It is also why Sisko brought down the wrath of God when Worf went back for his wife, rather than to save the Cardassians by. Now, I fault Starfleet Sisko for assigning the two of them to that particular mission. In the U.S. military, there is a thing known as fraternization, meaning that it is against the Uniform Code of Military Justice to date, marry, etc., someone in your direct chain of command. Now, Worf and Dax were thrown into it, but Picard, in the episode where he was dating the scientist on the ship, which would be Lessons, should have had the book thrown at him, because it does make that sort of decision that much harder. Okay, so let's talk about the Worf and Sisko portion of Brad's letter here, Matthew. What do you think about this?
I think it's right on. I really do see, Sisko kind of take Worf under his wing in that way and kind of shepherd him towards command, really helping him kind of see the differences in command. I mean, this actually happens, I think, the episode right after Way of the Warrior, where Worf is still kind of doing his security duties on top of doing the duties of in what he's been assigned to there on Deep Space Nine as the strategic command
officer. He's like butting
officer.
Heads with Odo, right? He's
exactly.
Like, why aren't you investigating this? Yeah.
And Captain Sisko kind of has to remind him that he's no longer in that position anymore and get used to a different way of thinking, because command is different than security. And I also think as well, it is one of the reasons why Sisko does throw the book at him after what happens with Jadzia. I mean, I think he's very glad that Jadzia is still alive, but at the same time, his harshness towards Worf there, even telling him, I don't think you'll ever get your own command. I don't know if Sisko actually really believes that, but I do think he's trying to put the gravity, the weight on Worf. So all these things I really do see him kind of liking having that really strong character next to him, that Klingon type of character. Mm-hmm. Sisko is very Klingon-ish in a lot of ways. I mean, he punches Q. That's kind of how he handles situations. And so he has a temper as well, just like Klingons tend to do. So, I really like his thoughts here about Worf and Sisko. And I honestly, in the show, I think I would have loved to have seen just a little bit more of this, because I think it would have been some really interesting storytelling. Not that Worf, and when we talked about this with the guys from Earl Grey, didn't get a lot of storylines here in Deep Space Nine, but that kind of depth between him and Sisko, I think, would have been as interesting to watch as well.
Yeah, I agree, Brad. I think you're right here that Sisko does see Worf as a protege, and he is trying to guide him on the command track. That makes a lot of sense to me, too. Matthew, Brad also talked about Worf and Jadzia, saying, this was probably one of the best romantic relationships in Star Trek. The two actors had such chemistry, even to the point where their comic-slash-straight-man shtick worked very well. They were talking on the runabout on the way to rescue the Cardassian spy, and they were bantering back and forth, then on comms with the spy. Jadzia says something, and he says, is that a joke? And she looks into the screen and says, no, he's the funny one. One of Worf's funniest lines in the show is where he is going on a mission with Garak in Purgatory's shadow and says, at the first sign of betrayal, I will kill him, but I promise to return the body intact. And Captain Sisko says, I assume that's a joke. And Worf says, we will see. But at the end of the episode, he had come to have a new respect for Garak. So quick, Matthew, what do you think here, Worf and Jadzia, romantic relationship? Straight man,
I don't
comedy.
Think, oh, yeah. Well, one, they're not just one of the best. I think they are the best romantic relationship in Star Trek. I don't think anybody's done it better. I think a very close second is Tom and B'Elanna, but I think Worf and Jadzia.
Because it was so natural feeling, right? It was just purely organic.
And again, not to take anything away from Tom and B'Elanna. Tom's my favorite character on Voyager, and I really enjoyed their relationship. But the moment these two shared a scene on screen, it was just magic. It really, really was. So, yeah, and their straight man and funny man routine is just fantastic because Michael Dorn just has that, you know, very dry sense of humor as Worf.
And then, he got better and better and better at it as his time on Star Trek went on, right?
Yes. And then, of course, you know, Terry Farrell's just a cut-up as Dax. And so it was great.
Yeah.
And especially the episode, you know, I do think of the episode where they're on the mission together. They have some great banter back and forth, and it's just fantastic. So very much reminds me of the classic Thin Man, Nick and Nora, Charles kind of routine. They're very much like that back and forth banter is and that's probably the most famous example of it. And so if you haven't kind of seen that, I would encourage listeners, go find that somewhere. It's an old black and white movie, but the banter back and forth is what every single movie kind of wants that kind of romantic comedy relationship to be, because they just nail it. So, and I think Worf and Jadzia really fit within that mold.
So one more part here to Brad's letter, still dealing with Jadzia. He says, one other thought on Jadzia. I think that even if Terry Farrell had stayed for season 7, they would have still come to the same conclusion with the Klingons. Okay, so Matthew, I think we talked about this. I guess we were speculating on what might have happened, perhaps. So that's what Brad said here. And then he said, because if nothing else, instead of Ezri's advice coming from the heart, Jadzia's would have come from the symbiont. I think he still would have killed crazy Uncle Gowron, but as to whether or not he would have become an ambassador, who knows? In fact, here's an interesting angle. Would the Klingons have offered the ambassadorship to Jadzia, what with Curzon's background, then Worf could have become a military attaché. So, first of all, I love the fact that we now have other people saying, you're crazy, Uncle Gowron.
The fact that we're just kind of influencing Star Trek fans with crazy Uncle Gowron is fantastic, because he really just is.
Yeah.
You know, they would have had to work it some way if Terry had stayed. I would have been very interested to see how they kind of wrote that. Now, whether or not she would have become an ambassador, I don't think so.
I think
this Dax was way too involved with, you know, science and trying to figure things out in that realm, and that's really what she brought to the character of the symbiont Dax. Like, that was one of the main things that she was able to offer the symbiont.
Well, I think the other problem here is that Worf became the Klingon ambassador to the Federation. Right, the Klingons are not going to make a Trill their ambassador to the Federation. Now, maybe Jadzia could have been the Trill ambassador to Kronos, perhaps. But no, I don't think that the Klingons would have offered an ambassadorship to Jadzia.
Well, and at that point, you know, at the end of the show, I think Worf's journey would have been very different. I think he may have actually stayed on Deep Space Nine. I think he actually could have maybe been captain of Deep Space Nine instead of Kira, who knows? And at that point, him and Jen Zia would have been thinking about having children if they could have children, trying to figure that out as well. So a whole storyline there would have been open, yeah. Which would have been fabulous to see. It is very sad that that just wasn't an opportunity. And spoiler alert, in the books, he doesn't really have much better luck. His paramour actually dies as well by the hand of David Mack. So.
Matthew, everyone eventually dies by the hand of David Mack.
That's very true. But I just feel bad for poor Worf. Every time that he gets involved with a woman, she dies. Apparently, he's the Constantine of the Star Trek universe.
So. I guess so. Well, the last thing that Brad had in his letter, this is a quick one, Martok, the everyman Klingon. Does that make Martok the Miles Edward O'Brien of the Klingon Empire? Yes,
I think it does. Yeah, I think he actually has the badge. That's the Miles Edward O'Brien badge. Yeah. It's kind of like your merit badge there, but he's got it. So,
all right. So, Brad, thanks for your letter and all those different thought-provoking angles there. Next one here, Matthew, is from Christopher Baca. What did Christopher say?
Well, he said, what episode of Deep Space Nine is your favorite? And which episode of the series has stuck with you after all these years? He says, my favorite episode is Call to Arms, the end of the episode where Sisko leaves the baseball behind, the station's ops in ruin, and the Defiant meets up with the Federation fleet. It's like the Deep Space Nine version of the best of both worlds. The episode that has stuck with me after all these years is The Visitor. I still can't watch the episode with dry eyes, especially since my dad passed away 2 years ago. That episode spoke to me when it was first on, and it still does today. Chris, what is your favorite episode of Deep Space Nine, or at least what are some of your favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine? I don't know if I could necessarily.
Yeah, it's hard to pick just one, right? It's hard. Well, I will say, Christopher, that I'm with you with The Visitor for very much the same reason that I lost my father about 2.5 years ago. And it's very hard to watch that. And same with me with Emissary, actually, because I lost my father the week before we were doing Emissary on the Ready Room. And it was really hard for me at that point to watch Emissary because of the flashbacks and the connections with Sisko and him losing Jennifer and just losing someone in your life. So I definitely hear you on this. As for my favorite episode, it is really hard to pick just one. The Visitor is on the list. In the Pale Moonlight really stands out for me. And we just talked about that on the Ready Room. Some other ones would be Far Beyond the Stars, because I love the way the story is told. I love Avery Brooks' performance in that story. I love seeing all the cast out of makeup doing their cameos. Past Tense is one that's always stuck with me. I may not like it quite as much today as I did when it first came on, and maybe like the first 10 years after that, but I still think it's a very great two-part story, and it remains relevant to our world even today. Sacrifice of Angels is also one that has always stuck with me. And probably the biggest reason is when Dukat holds out the baseball to Sisko and he says, I forgive you. And it's just that one scene has really stuck with me. And the baseball just running all the way through the series. So I love here, Christopher, that you mention A Call to Arms and the fact that Sisko leaves the baseball behind. I think for so many of us, some of these favorite moments in DS9 revolve around that baseball. And if I pick one more, I'll just throw out there a special one, Trials and Tribulations, because I remember being so amazed when it aired the first time and that they could actually merge Deep Space Nine and TOS in that way. And then as time has gone on, I've come to appreciate even more how they made it a DS9 story that had the TOS elements in it instead of it just being taking us back to TOS.
Chris, you know, I think you mentioned some of mine. I think everyone knows that my favorite episode is In the Pale Moonlight. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you take that and something like Far Beyond the Stars off the table, there's some other fantastic episodes. For me, the ones that are really sticking with me these days are the ones that really have such spiritual significance, and like The Reckoning, mm-hmm. You know, very much an Abraham type story where Sisko feels like he might need to sacrifice his son kind of thing. I think it's just a fantastic episode. That and Rapture, where he
yeah
he really
Rapture
comes
is one I was
going to
just mention
it, yeah.
as part of that, yeah.
And so that's really fantastic. But you know, I love The Visitor, and I haven't lost a father, but I still can't watch it and have dry eyes. I mean, it's just a fantastic episode. The acting in it is superb, and the relationship there between Sisko and Jake is it's exceptional. It is exceptional writing. For me, though, I think the one that has stuck with me the most throughout the years has been Emissary. The challenge of the prophets for Sisko of that, why do you live here?
Yeah.
Is, I think, one of the most amazing questions that has ever been asked in television. The idea that we get stuck and mired in the past, whether it was a mistake that we've made or something terrible that's happened to us that keeps us anchored there and kind of has the ability to, and really does in a lot of ways, ruin our lives because we're stuck there. And the freedom that comes from moving forward and finding a way to move forward is just enormous. And even from the beginning, they are starting this character on a very spiritual journey, and I really, really, really resonate with that plight that Sisko is in, because I've found that in my own life. I've been in that place, and every once in a while, I still will kind of find myself mentally in that place with things from the past. Mm-hmm. So it is, I think, just an incredible 2 hours of television, and a pilot that the more and more I've seen it, the more and more I am impressed with what they're setting up for the future, especially with what they do with it down the road. You know, it's not forgotten. It's capitalized on in every single way. So,
well, they set so much stuff up that they could, you know, I don't think they necessarily had it all planned out where they were going to take all the stuff they set up. But they packed so much stuff in there for Sisko as a character that there was so much they could come back to.
Exactly, exactly. And I think just in general, this writing team with that premiere put as many things as they could in there, and then they didn't forget about mm-hmm. them, and they found a way to make them work throughout the series. So yeah, that is the episode that just really stays with
me. Well, and you know, it's really the only Star Trek series where the pilot sets up the captain, because The Next Generation is about the new starship and the new crew. Voyager is about the ship getting lost and Starfleet and the Maquis having to come together. It's not about Janeway. And even Enterprise, it's about the humans breaking free of the Vulcans. It's not about setting up Archer. But yet, Emissary on DS9, what it does first and foremost is it sets up Sisko as the captain, even though he's a commander by rank at that point, but he's the leader of the station.
Well, it sets him up as a damaged man.
Right, exactly.
And throughout the series, they put him back together again. He's a bit like Humpty Dumpty.
All right, so thank you, Christopher, for your letter. And then we have one more to cover today, and this has two parts, and this is from Will Wynn. And Will says, I know you guys have talked about the Expanded Universe's Season 8 on Literary Treks, but I would love to hear your thoughts on what could have transpired with an actual Season 8 of DS9 on TV. Would Bajor finally join the Federation? Would Kira get a Starfleet commission? Who would come in to replace O'Brien, Worf, and Odo? Does Garrick finally become a main character? The possibilities are endless. So, Matthew, I actually want to just touch on this a little bit, because I actually think this would be a really good topic for an entire show at some point.
Yeah, looking at this question as I was putting together the list of notes that we've gotten from people, Chris, I was thinking that as well. I think, gosh, there's just so many possibilities. Obviously, I think that season 7 would have ended a little bit differently.
That's the first thing, right? Yeah.
We may have lost Sisko for a while, and it could have been like half a season or more, so that that gets dealt with. So I think that's a huge thing. I don't think maybe that the O'Briens leave, but maybe they do. I think that maybe pretty quickly Garrick is actually the leader of the Cardassian union at that point, and instead of as long as it takes in the book series. So those kind of things I could see happening. You know, I definitely don't think Worf leaves at that point either. We would see Ezri and Bashir kind of deepen their relationship and those kind of things. So, yeah, that's just a very quick answer for what I think might be able to happen.
I think for me, and let's do this as a full show sometime, because you have to approach this from two different angles. The question is, if they knew they were going to have 8 seasons, like you said, Matthew, season 7 would have ended differently than it did, probably. Now, if you approach it from everything ends as it did, what we saw on screen, but then they decided to do an 8th season and they have to work with everything that they finished, well, that creates an entirely different set of parameters to work with. If that were the case, to answer the really specific question that Will has here, would Bajor finally join the Federation? Then, and I'm going to throw out the literary universe here. I'm just thinking we don't have any of that. I think, yes, I think after the war is over, then Bajor would be admitted into the Federation. Would Kira get a Starfleet commission? Well, my first thought there was no, because she's Bajoran and she's going to be there. But if Bajor becomes part of the Federation, the Bajoran militia would be absorbed into Starfleet, so she would have to get a Starfleet commission unless she became a civilian. So I think that would take care of itself. Who would come in to replace O'Brien, Worf, and Odo? I mean, that's something I would have to think about a little bit more. Who would you bring in? Because if this were on television and you were doing an 8th season, would you be inclined to try to bring in some people, some characters that fans already know, instead of suddenly introducing a lot of new faces? Because we already saw when Ezri came in at the beginning of season 7, the writers feel like we have to create a lot of stories for this character so that people can get to know her. Well, if you bring in 3 new people, it's going to be really hard to allow you to get to know them over the course of a season. And especially if we're only talking about an 8th season, not like there are going to be 12, and so we can start really building new characters. So those are my quick thoughts on it as well. I think it's a great question, and we'll have to do it as a show where we can really flesh out the possibilities. The second part of Will's letter, Matthew, says, what if Section 31 found out about Sisko's and Garrick's deception in the Pale Moonlight? Sloan could have easily leveraged this information to dissuade Sisko from pursuing his investigation of Section 31, while also using it to disillusion Bashir over the ongoing moral compromises Starfleet has to make to win the war. I haven't read Una McCormick's Hollow Men, which I know is sort of a follow-up to In the Pale Moonlight, but I'm not sure it talks about Section 31. So, Matthew, I'll let you speak on that one.
You know, I think that even if Sloan found out, I don't think that he would have been able to disillusion Bashir at that point. I think that Bashir is pragmatic enough to be able to see that what that the captain did was in the best interest of everyone in the Alpha Quadrant. In fact, I mean, you have to remember, Bashir is the same guy who thought the Federation should surrender.
Right, because he had been convinced that he was...
Exactly.
I mean, he's like really into the possibilities of his genetic enhancements in that episode.
Right, and I think that you could easily as well be able to explain to him in a rational manner of why Sisko needed to do what he needed to do. Now, how that could have played out, and it almost makes me wonder if Section 31 didn't know. they seem to know everything. So I can't imagine them not really knowing this or being able to figure this out. So it's just a storyline that just never got picked up in, you know, Deep Space Nine. I think it would have been a good one. This is one of those things where you could have made a great storyline with it. And if you were going to have a season 8, you know, what if this came out after the war?
Yeah.
So that it's something that, you know, Sisko's gone and then his reputation is tarnished. Mm-hmm. You know, that huge. I mean, and Deep Space Nine is the only Star Trek show that would actually even think of tackling that. So, yeah, very big question here. And I think could have made for some great storylines.
It'd be kind of like college football where the team gets in trouble, player gets in trouble, and they have to forfeit a win. They would have to forfeit the victory in the war because Sisko's reputation is tarnished.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, Will, thank you for those questions. And everyone else, we would love to hear from you. We would love to have your questions for the next Orb of Mail. We're going to start stashing them in the front of the orb until the back door pops open again, and then we'll do another one of those shows. And we'll tell you how to send us your feedback in just a moment. But before then, here's a quick look at all of the other things that we've been talking about here on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And then next week, it's like, hey, Worf, what's going on? He's like, oh, not much. Just, you know, yeah, walking around the bridge. Like I didn't have my spine grown, you know, last week.
Earl Grey.
You know, he's on the Enterprise. He doesn't have to be written in the movie because, hey, he's on the Enterprise. Everyone's on the Enterprise.
He gets,
you know,
a chair.
He gets a chair. I mean, the whole beginning is all about his promotion. Yeah, exactly.
It's basically a Worf-centered movie now that I think about it.
The Orb.
Even Odo wasn't able to keep his, you know, quote-unquote hands clean. The fact that he has this kind of sordid past that we didn't really know about until now is really, really interesting.
To the journey!
I think the audience by and large, kind of saw Data as a machine and was probably a little more on the side of Maddox, as in Data is it, not he, and that sort of a thing, without even realizing it. And then Measure of a Man took us from that point to, you know what? This guy has the right to choose.
Warp 5.
The TV viewer who doesn't know anything about that, they're probably more like the actual people of the Enterprise era, where the idea that we would have these starships that can take us into the depths of the galaxy at Warp 5, this is all new for them as well.
The Ready Room.
Deep Space Nine is closer to the original series than any other Star Trek show in terms of ideals and, yeah, conflict. There is conflict in the original series.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
Wow. What's interesting, though, is this isn't even a threat. I mean, that be your last battlefield. It was a threat that Kirk was making in this episode. Picard's just like, yeah, we don't know who's taking our ship, and nobody's allowed to have our ship, so you know, let's blow it up.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Although there is a certain darker aspect to the story than, let's say, one would find in Roddenberry's version of humanity, there is also room for hope.
Literary Treks.
I can see that Jean-Luc might have told her, you know, I was reading Janeway's logs, and can you believe that Q got married and has a son?
Continuing Mission.
You're watching the Man Trap, and then for no reason at all, they go into the botany. Well, I want to call it the botany bay, even though I know that's not right. The botanical.
I think it's just botany room.
The botany room. And there's this person's hand in a pink glove as a space plant. And you're just like, what?
Melodic Treks.
The latest Thompson Holiday Company advert in the United Kingdom features William Shatner's rendition of the Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Axanar, the official podcast.
And as soon as I got back to L.A., I sat down and in about 3 or 4 days wrote this demo suite of 4 cues. And, you know, thankfully it resonated with Alec and Christian, and, you know, here we are.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what else we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can get our shows everywhere that you get podcasts or audio content. If you're an Apple user, go ahead and hit subscribe in iTunes or the podcasts app. Even if you stream the shows through those, if you subscribe, you'll get the shows immediately as soon as I hit publish. And also, it really helps us by allowing us to rise up in the rankings. And that helps other Deep Space Nine fans find the orb as they're searching for Star Trek podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, please leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear from you, and also that helps us rise up as well. Now, if you're not an Apple user, we have you covered in many other places. You can find us on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, BlackBerry, Windows Phone. We're also on SoundCloud. You can go to our website and you can stream from the show page. You can download the audio file from the show page, look in the SoundCloud player in the upper right corner, and you'll see the icon for downloading the file. And you can grab the RSS feed and pop that into any application that you like. Also, if you're an Android user and you want a really good podcatching application like we would use on iOS, there aren't as many of them on Android, but one that's really good is Pocket Casts. Go look up Pocket Casts. This is available for iOS as well, and as far as I know, it pulls from the iTunes catalog, even on Android. But it has a great interface, it's really easy to subscribe to podcasts, and that's a wonderful way for you to get our shows on the Android platform. And of course, Stitcher is a good way to do that as well. If you're on Windows Phone, Spreaker also has a Windows Phone app. So that's one way for you to get those besides just going through the Windows Phone or Xbox directory. Now, on to how you can send us your questions for the next Orb of Mail. There are many ways for you to get in touch with us. If you go to our website, go to trek.fm/contact and use the form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Orb and just send us your question. That'll come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also talk to us on Twitter, although that's a little bit difficult in terms of sending us real feedback for the show. But we'd love to talk to you there. Our username is TrekFM. Also, go over to our listeners forum on Facebook. It's called the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L. Type that into the search bar on Facebook or go to our website and click discussion on the menu. That'll take you there as well. It's a closed group, so you need to click join and then I'll let you in. But it's there specifically for listeners, and we have great discussions there. We've had some of the most in-depth DS9 discussions that I've ever been part of there on the Babel Conference. And that's a great way for you to send us feedback. I mentioned that Ruth had posted there that maybe Keiko felt guilty about not being able to carry the baby. That happened there in the Babel Conference as well. So come join us there. And you can send us voicemail, speakpipe.com/trekfm is the URL for that. You'll also find that on our website, the tool where you can do that. And you just need the mic on your webcam or your smartphone or your tablet. And we'd love to get voicemail from you as well. So send us your feedback for the next Orb of Mail. And just as we did today, we'll fill those questions here on the show. So Matthew, when you're not trying to repair the back door of the Orb of Mail, now that the lock's been busted open by all this listener feedback, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me on Literary Treks with you talking about the books and comics of Star Trek. And you can also find me as well now on the 602 Club, where we just kick back, have a drink, see if we can't maybe guess Ruby's names for her kids, because Norm's really excited about trying to find out her kid's names. He really wants that date. I actually just really wants to marry her. We talk about things all things geeky. So just anything that comes up that we want to talk about on the show, we get to do that now. It doesn't have anything to do with Star Trek, but it's still a lot of fun. So I hope everyone will join us there. And you can also find me on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not feeling guilty because you can't carry Miles' child either, where can we find you?
That's right, because I'm not Arnold Schwarzenegger, and I cannot carry a child as a man.
That's probably a good thing, because you would just talk like this, and then we would do the things for the we would review the shows, and you would be like, oh, there goes Captain Sisko, he's walking into his office and now he's walking down the stairs and now he's talking to Kiera.
I think Tristan has actually done that as a commentary on To the Journey before, as if he
I'm
were
sure
Arnold
he has.
What was that movie? What movie am I talking about? I remember seeing it. I can't remember the name of it right now.
I can't remember which one it is, but yeah, with Arnold on the commentary, he's literally just walking you through the action.
Step by step. All right. Well, before I give you my contact information, you mentioned Norm on the 602 Club. That's Norman C. Lau, who is an associate producer of The Orb as well. And I want to give a shout out to our associate producers, Norm, also Ruth Ward, who I mentioned in the show today as well, Lisa Stevens, and Will Wynn, who we also talked about with some feedback that Will had sent in. So thank you, Norm, Ruth, Lisa, and Will, for your support of the show here and for helping us develop The Orb for everyone. And if you'd like to get in touch with me when I'm not trying to figure out how to carry the O'Brien's next child, you can find me on Twitter, where my username is C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y. I'm just watching Matthew kind of fall apart here on camera. I'm also on Facebook, facebook.com/C. Brian Jones, and I'm in the Babel Conference. So come join us over there and we'll talk about Deep Space Nine and Star Trek in the Babel Conference. And then elsewhere on the network, of course, Matthew and I do Literary Treks together. And beyond Literary Treks, you can find me on a lot of shows: Warp 5, Continuing Mission, Matter Stream, Hyper Channel, The Ready Room. Also, I co-host the official podcast of Star Trek Axanar with Axanar creator and executive producer Alec Peters. So check out all of those shows if you want to hear more of my thoughts on the world of Star Trek. Before we let you go, we would also like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. Go pick up any book you like absolutely free as a Trek FM listener if you're not already an Audible customer by going to audibletrial.com/trekfm. They have so many audiobooks there, about 150,000, 160,000 or more right now. Most new books that come out, unfortunately not Star Trek books, but pretty much everything else, including Star Wars hardcover novels, come out in audio format these days when they're released as hardcover or paperback. And so you can get those there. It's a great way to read all the books you've always wanted to read, but thought you'd never have time for because you don't have time to sit down and read the print. But you can listen to audiobooks as you're doing all the other things in your daily life. So check that out, audibletrial.com/trekfm. If you decide not to stick with Audible, you'll get to keep that book, so there's nothing to lose. But when you try Audible, it really does help us keep The Orb coming to you every week. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. And also, go over to enterpriseinspace.org and check out this project, Enterprise in Space, which Larry Nemechek and I are both involved in today. This is a project of the National Space Society that will build and launch an orbiter called the NSS Enterprise, which will carry more than 100 student-designed experiments into space. It will be returned to Earth as well, and it will also be testing new space technologies. And in addition to the educational element, there's a contest going on right now where you can actually design the ship. And you don't need to be an engineer. We have engineers who will do that portion of the project for you. It's just the visual side. If you have an idea of what the ship would look like, you can enter the competition. So go to enterpriseinspace.org, find out how to enter that competition, learn more about the educational aspects of the project, and donate and become a supporter. And you can, in fact, get National Space Society membership for much less than it would normally cost and support EIS at the same time. Again, that's enterpriseinspace.org. I hope you'll go check it out.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.